This is the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the book of Genesis. Now, here's Pastor Sandy in the book of Genesis, chapters 35 through 38.
The covenant that God made to Abraham also belongs to Israel and his sons. Then God went up from him in the place where he talked with him. And so Jacob set up a pillar in the place where he talked with him, a pillar of stone. And he poured a drink offering on it, and he poured oil on it. Jacob gathers up a pile of rocks. And they serve as a memorial, a spiritual landmark. And you know, I believe these kinds of milestones are important in our relationship with God. They remind us of important events, key happenings in our relationship with God. You know, I've talked to a lot of believers, for example, who struggle with assurance of their salvation. And I think it's because they lack a point in time where they can go back and they can say, that's when I gave my life to Jesus Christ. They lack a landmark, a milestone, a pillar. These landmarks are valuable. Baptism serves this purpose. They provide a purpose. They provide a place, really, for our faith to stand. Important dates, events, experiences. As I said, our baptism all serve this purpose. For years to come, this pile of stones at Bethel will mark Jacob's transformation. And Jacob called the name of the place where God spoke with him, Bethel. Verse 16. Then they journeyed from Bethel, and when there was but a little distance to go to Ephrath, Rachel labored in childbirth, and she had hard labor. And now it came to pass, when she was in hard labor, that the midwife said to her, "Do not fear, you will have this son also." And so it was, as her soul was departing, for she died, that she called his name Benoni, which means son of sorrow. But his father called him Benjamin, or son of my right hand, or the position of honor. And so Rachel died and was buried on the way to Ephrath, that is Bethlehem. And Jacob set a pillar on her grave, which is the pillar of Rachel's grave to this day. In fact, on our last trip to Israel, we went to Bethlehem and we stopped off and paid a visit to Rachel's tomb, right on the road outside Bethlehem. You remember when Leah began to have children, you remember Rachel went to Jacob and she was so upset. And you remember what she said to him? "Give me children or I'll die." Oh boy, better be careful what you ask for. Because here she does have a child, and yet she dies. Be careful what you ask for. Be careful what you demand of God. You know, I've gotten to the point where I don't demand anything of God. I trust God to give me what I need, what He knows is best. It's interesting, too, that 2,000 years after Benjamin was born, another child was born in Bethlehem. And you remember Jesus began His life as a son of my sorrow, you might say. He was a suffering servant, culminating with the agony on the cross. But later, remember, His Father changed His name to son of my right hand. And when Jesus rose from the dead and ascended into heaven, He sat down at the right hand of God in heaven, and there He sits today. Benjamin is a type, really, of Jesus. Then Israel journeyed and pitched his tent beyond the Tower of Eder. And it happened when Israel dwelt in the land that Reuben went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine, and Israel heard about it. You remember, Bilhah was Rachel's maid. Reuben was Jacob's firstborn, and their sin was incest. And it cost Reuben dearly. It was because of this sin, we'll see later, that Reuben forfeits the rights of the firstborn of this family. He could have been the father of the Messiah. It could have been his privilege to be the head of that ancestral line that would give birth to Jesus Christ. But instead, he forfeits that privilege. And I suppose all that happened to Reuben is they just named a sandwich after him. Now the sons of Jacob were 12. The sons of Leah were Reuben, Jacob's firstborn, and Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun. The sons of Rachel were Joseph and Benjamin. The sons of Bilhah, Rachel's maidservant, were Dan and Naphtali, and the sons of Zilpah, Leah's maidservant, were Gad and Asher. These were the sons of Jacob who were born to him in Paddan Aram. Here's the family roll call. Jacob's boys will become the 12 tribes of Israel. You know, it's amazing how the future of the nation Israel parallels the life of the man with the same name. Notice the similarities. There's several. Both are forced into exile because of their sin. While away, both yearn to return home. Both develop into crafty businessmen. Jacob up in Haran, all his dealings with Laban. The Jews certainly have a reputation for shrewdness today. Both are preserved and prospered by the providence of God. Both become wanderers. And then finally, in God's time, both return to the land of promise. Interesting parallels there. Verse 27. Then Jacob came to his father Isaac at Mamre, or Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, where Abraham and Isaac had dwelt. Now the days of Isaac were 180 years. And so Isaac breathed his last and died, and was gathered to his people, being old and full of days. And his sons Esau and Jacob buried him. Evidently, they not only buried their dead, but they also buried the hatchet. For the family's sake, the two brothers, who never got along, finally did, and they worked together to make funeral arrangements. Chapter 36. Now, this is the genealogy of Esau, who is Edom. Now, later in the Old Testament, we're going to read a lot about the Edomites. Remember, they were Esau's descendants. It says, Esau took his wives from the daughters of Canaan. Adah, the daughter of Elon the Hittite. Aholabama, the daughter of Anah, the daughter of Zibeon the Hivite. And Basemath, Ishmael's daughter, sister of Nebaioth. Esau had three wives, and notice they were all three pagan princesses. Sadly, he married idolatrous women. Verse 4. Now Adah bore Eliphaz to Esau, and Basemath bore Reuel, and Aholabama bore Jeush, Jalam, and Korah. These were the sons of Esau who were born to him in the land of Canaan. Then Esau took his wives, his sons, his daughters, and all the persons of his household, his cattle and all his animals, and all his goods which he had gained in the land of Canaan, and went to a country away from the presence of his brother Jacob. The Edomites settled south of the Dead Sea, east of the Dead Sea as well, and in later years, the Edomites become neighbors of Israel. He says, for their possessions were too great for them to dwell together, and the land where they were strangers could not support them because of their livestock. And so Esau dwelt in Mount Seir. Esau is Edom. In later years, the capital of Edom becomes the rock city of Petra. You've seen the facade of Petra. It was used in the movie Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. It was the entrance to that cave where he went in and found the Holy Grail. That's the rock city of Petra. That was the capital of the Edomites. Other notes of interest. King Herod, at the time of Jesus, was an Edomite. The book of Obadiah, you might read it later, was a prophecy written to warn the nation of Edom of coming judgment. And in verse 12, notice the name Amalek appears, perhaps the father of the Amalekites. We'll find them later when Moses brings the children of Israel out of Egypt. And notice one other point of interest. Notice verses 4, verse 10, and verse 12 mention the name Eliphaz. Also notice in verse 33 we find the name Jobab, or for short, Job. And it's because of these characters, their appearance here in Genesis, and also their appearance in the book of Job, that many Bible scholars believe Job was one of the first books of the Bible actually written, that Job was actually written during the period of the patriarchs before Moses wrote Genesis. And so Job may have been the very first book actually written. As for the remainder of Esau's genealogy, I'll let you go home tonight, you and your wife cuddle up on the couch, get some hot chocolate, and you can just read the genealogy of Esau for yourself. Chapter 37 begins with the fascinating story of Joseph. And more than 25% of the book of Genesis is preoccupied with Joseph. He's an important character. In fact, more biblical ink goes to describing the life of Joseph than almost anyone else, except for Jesus, of course, and maybe even King David. James Montgomery Boyce, he penned these words about Joseph. He was loved and hated, favored and abused, tempted and trusted, exalted and abased. Yet at no point in the 110-year life of Joseph did he ever seem to get his eyes off God or cease to trust him. Adversity did not harden his character. Prosperity did not ruin him. He was the same in private as in public. He was a truly great man. And we're going to find over the next few chapters, we're going to learn a lot from the life of Joseph. Well, chapter 37 begins. Now Jacob dwelt in the land where his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. This is the history of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brothers. And the lad was with the sons of Bilhah, that was Dan and Naphtali, and the sons of Zilpah, that was Gad and Asher, his father's wives. And Joseph brought a bad report of them to his father. In other words, he snitched. Joseph was honest with his dad, and he told him what he needed to know, even though it incriminated his brothers. And you can bet this didn't make his brothers very fond of Joseph. They get infuriated with him further in verse 3. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children because he was the son of his old age. You know, Israel really bears the blame for how the brothers treated Joseph. He created this situation of intense sibling rivalry, which brings up a point for parents. Parents, don't play favorites. I admire my parents. I mean, I was the perfect kid, really. Smart, good-looking, always obedient. And my little brother, snotty-nosed brother, you know, he was always in trouble. But you know, they never played favorites, never did, never showed any, well, whatever. Just kidding. They really didn't, though. They reminded me at Christmas time, you remember, we always bought, if we bought $57.97 worth of presents for you, we bought $57.97 worth of presents for your brother. They did. They worked real hard, never to show any kind of prejudice. And if you've got multiple kids, understand, you'll be tempted to. There will be one kid who you'll have more in common with than the others. Or perhaps your personalities match. Or maybe the circumstances around their birth make them special. Like Joseph, he could be the son of your old age. But let me warn you. Favor one child over the other. Slight one and show favoritism to the other. And you'll create all kinds of dissension and conflict in your home. Here is proof. The home of Israel. And if ever there was a dad who should have known better, it was Jacob. You remember, it was his dad, Isaac, who always favored his older brother, Esau, over him. I'm sure there were a million times he said, I'll never do this once I get to be a father. And look at it. He did. You ever had that same thought? You find yourself acting just like your father? Boy, that's a scary thing. Now Israel is repeating the same mistake that he once resented, the same mistake that his father had made. And the next verse throws gas on the fire. Also, he made him a tunic of many colors. Now, I thought tonight that I would teach chapter 37 wearing my high school letter jacket. And I want you to look at this. Almost 30 years later, and it just fits like a glove. Isn't that amazing? Look at that. And I can remember, man, when I was 18 years old, how I loved to walk around in this letter jacket. As a matter of fact, you don't really walk around in a letter jacket. You strut around. in a letter jacket. Because a letter jacket, you know, it's got all these little icons on the letter there that point out your accomplishments and all the successes and all the talents and abilities that you have. And you walk around, you kind of strut around in your letter jacket. You know, you could basically call it a coat of conceit. That's pretty much what it is. If Israel had bought all of his sons a coat of many colors, there wouldn't have been a problem. But he only bought one of these fancy letter jackets, and he gave it to Joseph. He was the only one who had a jacket. And boy, did it make his big brothers jealous. They were upset. Look at verse 4. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. A father's favoritism and a silly jacket contributed to tear this family apart. Actually, one translation of the phrase tunic of many colors reads a long sleeve coat, which was the landowner's attire. Common workers, they wore short sleeves. Joseph, though, had this coat. He wore long sleeves. And the impression that it left the brothers was that he was something special. He was more important than the rest of them. He was the white-collar son, while the others were the blue-collar sons. Every time Adam and Hoss saw little Joe strutting around the Ponderosa in his letter jacket, their hatred just grew. The bitterness was brewing, it was boiling, it was ready to explode. And Joseph, poor Joseph, he didn't do anything to help matters. You remember back in verse 2, he snitched, he tattled. And in verse 5, he tells his brother about a dream he had. We're told, now Joseph had a dream and he told it to his brothers and they hated him even more. Joseph never learned that one of the keys to a happy family life is leaving a few things unsaid. I hope all the husbands have learned that. No, Joseph, he had to spill the beans, verse 6. So he said to them, please hear this dream which I have dreamed. There we were binding sheaves in the field. And then behold, my sheaf arose and also stood upright, and indeed your sheaves stood all around and bowed down to my sheaf. In other words, I had this dream, and your Wheaties were bowing down to my Wheaties. And his brother said to him, shall you indeed reign over us, or shall you indeed have dominion over us? So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Now the dream was true. But the brothers didn't dare want to admit that they would one day have to submit to this bratty little brother, daddy's little pet. You know, when you read how the brothers reacted, either Joseph was guilty of a little self-pride, a little spiritual pride, I guess you could say. Either there was a tinge of that in Joseph, or he was just totally oblivious to the obvious. It could have been the latter. It could have been that Joseph really didn't sin, but at best, he needed a lesson in some tact and diplomacy. For Joseph has a second dream, and it has the same impact. In fact, this time he even enrages his father. Verse 9, then he dreamed still another dream and told it to his brothers and said, look, I have dreamed another dream, and this time the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars bowed down to me. In other words, mom, dad, my 11 brothers, they all bowed down to me. The whole family will one day bow down to me. And so he told it to his father and his brothers. And his father, you remember the one who loved him, he rebuked him and said to him, what is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall your mother and I and your brothers indeed come to bow down to the earth before you? And his brothers envied him, but his father kept the matter in mind. And it's this jealousy that sets us up for the first movement in Joseph's story. For 14 chapters now, we're going to embark on a journey with Joseph. We're going to follow him from the pit to Potiphar's, to the prison, and finally to the palace. And Joseph's life is a showcase of another P word, and that's providence. For God is sovereign over all situations. And the life of Joseph proves that God is behind the scenes. God is moving and accomplishing his plans, even when we don't see his hand. Joseph's life illustrates the truth. Our disappointments are often God's opportunities. Well, verse 12 tells us, "Then his brothers went to feed their father's flock in Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, 'Are not your brothers feeding the flock in Shechem? Come, I will send you to them.' So he said to him, 'Here I am.' Then he said to him, 'Please go and see if it is well with your brothers and well with the flocks, and bring back word to me.' So he sent him out of the valley of Hebron, and he went to Shechem." Which brings up two more P words in the story of Joseph: picture and prophecy. For Joseph is a picture and a prophecy of Jesus Christ. In the Old Testament, God often speaks of New Testament realities through what we call types or analogies. It's been said typology is a species of prophecy. You may have heard the old saying, what's concealed in the old is revealed in the new, and what's revealed in the new is concealed in the old. It's true. And Joseph here is an excellent example. Joseph is an amazing type of Jesus Christ. Hebron means communion or fellowship, which is exactly what Joseph was enjoying, communion with his father Jacob, until he's sent to Shechem. And throughout the Bible, Shechem is associated with sin and sorrow. And what a picture we have here of Jesus Christ. The gospel story begins with the Father and the Son in heaven, communing with each other in unbroken fellowship until the Son is sent into the world of sin and sorrow, sent to Shechem. And like Joseph, Jesus came into the world to check on his brothers, the Jewish people. And what did the Jews do but conspire to kill him? Exactly what happens to Joseph when he arrives in Shechem. The parallels throughout this story are uncanny. It's almost as if God planned all this out years in advance. Verse 15. "Now a certain man found him, and there he was, wandering in the field. And the man asked him, saying, 'What are you seeking?' And so he said, 'I am seeking my brothers. Please tell me where they are feeding their flocks.' And the man said, 'They have departed from here, for I heard them say, let us go to Dothan.' So Joseph went," and the word Dothan, by the way, means law. And where did Jesus find the Jewish people when he returned? He found them immersed and steeped in the law. "And so Joseph went after his brothers and found them in Dothan. Now when they saw him afar off, even before he came near them, they conspired against him to kill him." Joseph is about to step into a pile of trouble. Verse 19, "Then they said to one another, 'Look, this dreamer is coming. Come, therefore, let us now kill him and cast him into some pit. And we shall say, some wild beast has devoured him. We shall see what will become of his dreams.' But Reuben," who was eating his sandwich, "heard it, and he delivered him out of their hands and said, 'Let us not kill him.' And Reuben said to them, 'Shed no blood, but cast him into this pit, which is in the wilderness, and do not lay a hand on him, that he might deliver him out of their hands and bring him back to his father.'" That was what he was thinking. That was Reuben's intention. He wanted to bring little Joe back to the Ponderosa. But that's not how the story plays out. Verse 23, "So it came to pass, when Joseph had come to his brothers, that they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the tunic of many colors that had been given to him. And then they took him and cast him into a pit. And the pit was empty, there was no water in it. And they sat down to eat a meal." Notice how cavalier they are about it. I mean, they just assault their brother, throw him into a pit, and they, "Oh man, I worked up an appetite. Let's get a sandwich. How about a Reuben sandwich?"
Being on the go is something we're all accustomed to in this culture. The hustle and bustle of life seems to make the days just fly by. For most of us, our smartphones are sort of an extension of our bodies, constantly ringing and dinging, telling us where to be and what the next appointment is. The technology that we enjoy in this day and age is amazing. And while there's certainly no end to the bad things we can find online and through our smartphones, There's also some great kingdom-minded options. We'd like to invite you to download the Sandy Adams mobile app. Our mobile app is available for iPhone, Android, and Windows smartphones. Or log on to sandyadams.org and simply click on the link from the main menu. When you download the app, you'll be able to listen to the most recent messages taught by Pastor Sandy, browse the series archive, and search the archive alphabetically. Finally, when you download the mobile app, you'll also have the opportunity to join us live for our Sunday morning worship service right from your smartphone. Again, to download the Sandy Adams mobile app, simply enter Sandy Adams in the search options of your smartphone's app store, or log on to sandyadams.org and simply click on the mobile app option right on the homepage. And please join us again as Pastor Sandy continues teaching through the Bible right here on Sandy Adams Radio.